Good afternoon. Thank you for dropping by. Today's presentation is about developing enterprise web apps on Microsoft Azure websites. I'm Stefan Schakow. I work on the product team for this service. And just as a real brief intro, we view Azure websites as an enterprise-class solution that lets you concentrate on writing your code, testing your code, and running your code in the cloud while we take care of a lot of the underlying management of the infrastructure so that you don't have to necessarily worry about that. Now, our service went live about 2.5 years ago, and since then, the pace of change has basically moved us at a lightning pace, which is probably not surprising both for our service and everyone else running in Azure. And that means that we've added a lot of functionality to the service over the intervening time. We've invested very heavily in three core pillars, and those are supporting enterprise-class line-of-business mission-critical apps, being able to run those kinds of apps at global scale, and giving you a suite of DevOps manageability tools and capabilities so that you can run those kinds of sites. Now, clearly, we don't have enough time here today to go through everything you see here on the slide, but what we did is we put together a demonstration ASP.NET application. It's a little mini travel app, so it's something where maybe an employee would go to create requests to go travel to a corporate client. And we made use of a number of the core features across the areas of enterprise website scaling and DevOps capabilities. Some of these features are relatively new and have only come out in the last few weeks. Some of them have actually been available in our service for a few months now, but they're not necessarily the most publicized or the most well-understood features. And hopefully, by the time we're done here today, you'll have a really good grounding of how you can use all of these different features to build an enterprise app. So, with that intro, this is sort of the high-level overview of what this web app does. It's a website running on us. Today, we're going to use the recently introduced VPN connectivity to access a SQL Server, a quote-unquote on-premises SQL Server that we have running in a private VNet up in Azure. And then we also have in that private VNet an Active Directory domain controller that we've already federated with Azure Active Directory, and that will enable us to log into our cloud-based web app using our corporate credentials. And then furthermore, we've gone out and enabled a number of cloud services to be trusted by our Azure Active Directory. And so after we're logged in, we are able to carry along those credentials to authenticate and authorize against, in this case, both Office 365 and Salesforce. Now, this is actually the underlying view of how we put together the demo app and setup that we're going to walk through today. In reality, we have not one, but six copies of this website deployed. They're deployed in two different regions. One is in our West U.S. data center, and one is in our North Europe data center. We've intentionally carved up the deployment so that the website is running in what we call three different web hosting plans in each of those regions. And you'll see over the course of the talk why we did that and how we're going to leverage that separation. And then sort of behind the scenes out the back end, like I mentioned earlier, we use the VPN connectivity feature to tunnel back to a SQL Server that we have running in a private VNet up in Azure. And then all of this is sitting behind a Traffic Manager profile. So when we go to our website using our friendly custom domain name, it's actually being resolved by way of Windows Azure Traffic Manager, and then behind the scenes, ultimately, requests will get sent to the instance of our website that is quote-unquote closest to where we are. And as you would expect today, that means most of our requests are going to be coming out of the North Europe data center. So with that sort of overview of both the logical and physical topology of the app, let's switch over to the demo laptop. And first, just real quickly, I'll bring you into the front page of the app. So I'm going to click through, and the very first thing that we see is, of course, the Microsoft login, which is not what we want. So I'll go incognito, and I'll log in instead against my sample corporate Active Directory. And you can see that this login page looks a lot like what you would get when you were logging into, say, Outlook or Office 365. And the reason why is that we set up earlier our Active Directory domain controller with Azure AAD. So the net result is we get sort of bounced around and ping-ponged through the login loop that you would normally see with other Microsoft properties. And so at this point, I am successfully logged in. You can see what the friendly domain name is here. It's travel.contoso.web.net. And you can also see that in the upper right-hand corner, we've got a little marker that tells us specifically what data center the website is coming out of. And actually, you'll see it further on here in the talk, also which specific quote-unquote deployment slot we're actually running the website out of. So what this is actually telling us is we're running the main production site out of the North Europe data center. And then again, I'll come back to it later on in the presentation, but the one row of data that you currently see displayed here is actually coming from a query running against our on-premises, or in this case, our simulated on-premises SQL Server database that's running inside of an Azure VNet. This data is not, for example, coming out of SQL Azure. So, okay, great. You've seen the quick overview of the app. You've seen sort of what it does in the main. So now what I wanted to do is sort of start out from the point of view in the day of the life of a developer. So I have Visual Studio 2013 loaded up on my laptop. I've got the solution, which in this case has a bunch of, 15 projects in it across both web and client-based apps. The main thing here today that we'll be working with is the web project and making some changes to the data model that this web project depends on. Now, what happened was a little bit before this talk, I went in and I actually made a code change here in one of my data classes, and I specifically changed the format of the company name that you saw on the front page. Now, even though I made the change here on my laptop, if I switch over here and take a look at the Visual Studio Online portal, what you'll see is in Visual Studio Online, we actually already set up our solution and our project quite a while ago. And in fact, the entire solution, all 15 projects worth, is not hosted on my laptop. It's hosted online in the cloud in Visual Studio Online. And what I did a few weeks ago was I clicked the handy little link here that says open in Visual Studio 2013, and I was able to slurp the entire solution and project structure down onto my machine. Now, obviously, I'm not going to do that today because it's probably about 500 meg worth of content, and we'd be sitting here drinking coffee while it came to pass. But the main point here is that once we got the code in a central location in VSO, in Visual Studio Online, it means anyone anywhere, as long as they can connect up to the cloud, can pull down the same set of code, and we can all be working against a common source code repository. So, for example, that change I made on my laptop about an hour ago, if I click in here into the browser and take a look at the change set history for my Visual Studio Online project, I can see, yeah, sure enough, a little while ago, I went out and I made a change, and it'll actually pull up and show you the code diff of the change that I made locally on my laptop. Now, we didn't stop there in terms of how we made use of Visual Studio Online for holding our website code. We also set up the continuous integration and continuous deployment features in VSO. So, for example, once I ended up making that check-in, you can see here off in the builds window in Visual Studio, apparently about 42 minutes ago and 33 minutes ago, we kicked off two CI and CDs for both the Europe and the West US deployments of our website. And if I zoom out here and take a look at the summary view, you can see, sure enough, for my North Europe deployment of my travel app site, and this thing in parentheses is the name of the slot. There's a slot called dev, and don't worry, we'll see it here in a minute in the portal. We went out and we used Visual Studio Online's hosted build controllers, so they went out and provided the resources to build my code. And then when they were done building my code, they went ahead and automatically deployed it. You can see right here to this URL, travelappne-dev-azurewebsites.net, which is, that is actually the internet accessible endpoint for, again, the North Europe deployment of my app, and specifically the deployment slot called dev. And that's important because part of the way in which Azure Website supports enterprise development is that we recognize you don't go out and make a code change live on your production servers. Or at least I hope most of us, most of the time, don't actually end up having to do that. So what you want is you want a lot more control over where and how you make changes to a development version of your code, and then how you bring that code along and sort of promote it up into production. And what I'm showing you here is the first step of how I go from making a code change on my laptop, synchronizing it in the cloud, and then pushing those updated bits into an isolated developer slot. And to show you what I mean by that in action, let's come back here into my browser. And this time around, I'm going to click in specifically to the dev slot for my travel site. Now, there'll be a little bit of a delay because the fact that it got updated and so some bits got overwritten. It's an ASP.NET MVC app, so it's going to take a little bit of time to warm up. But once it kicks into gear and turns over here, we'll see, sure enough, right in the middle of the page, that is no longer showing the name of the company I'm traveling to. Instead, it's just showing some identifier. So there's the production version of my site that, you know, if this were a real app, my live customers would continue to see and use. And here's the dev slot version of my site. And then in terms of, you know, what does it look like again in the browser, you can see, sure enough, there it is, travelappne-dev. So I can directly access it. And then because of the fact that I'm actually using the same browser session, you may have seen it there. I didn't actually have to physically log in again, but you may have seen the address bar blip around with a couple of redirects. So this site, even though it's the developer slot, it's still protected by the login that requires me to provide valid corporate credentials. So I can still use the same authentication scheme as my main site. And then again over here, you can see in the marker telling us we're running the dev slot out of North Europe. So, okay, so far so good. I've made a change. I've got it into a developer slot. Now what I want to do is figure out how I can somehow move that change into production and do that in a way that minimizes the hit in terms of performance and functionality to my external customers. So before I do that, what I want to do here is blip back into the browser, and what I have pulled up here is the preview portal for Azure. So you know there's the main production portal, and then we've been working for the past year or so on an updated version, aka this is the preview portal. And I'm logged in here, and you can see in my subscription I've got a few websites, and the one we're interested in right here is the North Europe website. And if I click into it a bit, we'll be able to scroll down and take a look at the available deployment slots that I've set up for this website. So you can see here there's a little web part called deployment slots. And if I click into that, you can see, sure enough, in addition to my main website, I have a slot that's called dev, and that was the one we were just looking at. And I've got another slot which I called prod B. And the reason why I called the other slot prod B is I'm actually going to use it to sort of stage production traffic into. Now, you can go ahead and have upwards of 5 slots in addition to your main website. And every single one of these slots is actually its own little self-contained copy of your website. And you can choose to set it up with different things like different connection strings, application settings. And so, for example, you can have the code base in the dev slot pointed off at a developer database and the code in your production slot pointed at your main production database so that when you're sitting there testing and doing things in the cloud, you're not actually blowing up, for example, your production systems. Now, what we want to do is we want to take the code that's currently here in dev, and I want to put it into the prod B slot. Now, there's any number of ways to do it. I'm going to take the nice, simple, straightforward way and drop back in here into Visual Studio. I'm going to right-click on my web project, and I'm going to say I'd like to publish it. And in this case, I'm specifically going to say I want to publish it to this instance of the prod B slot. You'll see we've actually set this up ahead of time so I can publish to any one of these 6 different copies of my site that I'm running, but I want it today to go to the prod B slot that's running in the North Europe data center. So we'll let things sort of recompile there on my machine, and then it'll go do a web deploy diff and a sync up into the cloud. Shouldn't take too long since ultimately the only thing that changed were a handful of DLLs. And now we can see here, it's popped me up in the browser. And while it's spinning up, you can see the URL, Travel App NE, but in this case, it says dash prod B. So now I'm accessing a third slot that's associated with my website. Now again, in this case, it's going to take a little while to come up. And this is actually, again, one of the reasons why having different slots for your website is so important, because we recognize the fact that for anything other than a trivial app, there's probably some amount of warm-up that you're going to go through before you want the new version of that code actually released and pushed out into production. And that warm-up can actually end up taking a fair amount of time. And you would like to actually incur, for example, the cost of warming up caches or activating back-end network connectivity. You'd like that all to happen off to the side before any of your external customers actually see the new site and have to experience it. So at this point, great, my app finally came up, right? So for the purposes of this app, I'm done with my quote-unquote warm-up, and I can again verify the fact that I can see the change is actually there. So now what I want to do is take the final step, and I want this version of the code to actually come up when I'm browsing my main production URL. And this is the point where I want to introduce another feature called testing in production. And you can see here, it's right below the deployment slots part. And if I click into it, it tells me some pieces of information that I have set up for my site. So it's telling me that apparently I've set up what we call a ramp-up rule. And we've set a rule that says, you know something, when traffic comes in to that main URL, route 0% of it right now to that prod B slot, and put 100% of the traffic on the actual main production website. And what I can do, and what I will do here shortly, is I can change those weights so that, for example, if I want to, I can just say, you know something, right now let's flip 100% of the traffic in the other direction. Or even better, I can go out and be very intentional and say, you know, I'd only like 10% of all production traffic to go over to the new version of my code and keep the other 90% of the customers on the old version of my code. And as you can imagine, that's very, very useful if, for example, you'd like to switch over just a slice of your customers onto your new code, then step back for a bit, maybe wait, monitor, see what kind of errors and events you're getting in production, and only after you have confidence that the new slice of your website is running, shift over more and more of the traffic. Now, there's another neat little trick here, I'm going to actually cancel out of this, that you can do with slots and with testing in production, which is you can actually access any individual slot that you have set up with testing in production by giving us a hint on the URL. So what I'm going to do here is go to travelcontosoweb.net, and then I'm going to type in ms-routing-name and give it the name of that slot, prod B. And what will happen is, once I log into the site, you'll see we actually show up on the new version of the code as opposed to the old version of my code. So go out and log in. Let it chug through the redirects. And then when it comes up, what we'll see is the ID is actually showing here on the home page. And you can see, even though I'm actually going to travelcontosoweb.net, it's this hint that I put on the URL that tells our front-end routing infrastructure that, oh, wait a second, I should ignore any of the weights that I have set up for distributing the traffic, and I should instead explicitly route you to the version of the code, in this case, identified with prod B. And so that's also a useful trick, because in some cases you may have testing tools or warm-up tools that for various reasons are hard-coded to sort of the custom domain or the vanity domain of your main site. And as opposed to having to go back through all of those pieces of code and change over the URLs, you can instead hopefully give it this query string value and very quickly take the same set of test tools and run them against a specific slot. So at this point, though, I think what we'll do is say, great, for the heck of it, let's come in here and let's go ahead and switch 99% of my traffic over to the prod B slot. And you notice that when I fill in these values, I don't actually have to go out and type in the final value for production. The deal is, when you set up one or more slots, and in this case, I only have another slot that I could choose in this list, but if I have five, I can put in as many as five different slots with five different percentages, and then whatever is left over is what basically gets allocated to production. And for that matter, that number, as you saw before, can very well be 0%. So great, let's once again come back in here to our site. I'm going into travelcontosoweb.net. Oop. Well, it's not going to recognize that, so let me give it the right one. Okay, so once again, we'll go ahead and log in. And this time round, unless I'm really unlucky and I happen to get a random number between 99 and 100, we should end up seeing the new version of the code running on our website. Okay, and sure enough, so now I'm running against travelcontosoweb.net. I'm not using any special hints to my front ends, and I am now actually seeing the new version of the code running live in production. So in a nutshell, you saw we first put the code into the dev slot, then we pushed it into the prod B slot, and then we used testing in production to actually switch the traffic over. And so also I know sometimes we get questions from folks saying, hey, in the web roles and worker roles, I can do the equivalent of a VIP swap. Well, that testing in production feature is how you do the equivalent of a VIP swap. You can get your code all staged into a different slot and then change the weightings and basically flip it from 0 to 100% and blammo, you're now running all of your traffic against the new version of the code. Another thing I just wanted to highlight is everything you see in the portal is accessible through the REST APIs, and then we have wrappers on top of the REST APIs, both PowerShell and the cross-platform command line interface. This is the PowerShell that I can use to go out and actually set the weight of my prod B slot to 0. So I'll kick it off to run in the background, and while that's going on, you see basically all we do is we create a collection. This is this routing rule collection, and it contains one or more ramp-up rules. And so, for example, here I'm basically saying, guess what? I want you to route 0% of your traffic to the slot that's identified by travelappne-prodb. And then I stick it into my collection of ramp-up rules, and in my case, I only have one of them, so I say, great, on my website, this is how I want you to manage traffic to production. Here's the set of ramp-up rules. Now, what's cool about that is you can go out and write a fully automated set of your own custom logic for how you want to ramp production over to a new version of your code. Right? You could go out, for example, and say, I want 10% of the traffic to go to prod B. Now I'm going to go out and, for example, sniff HTTP logs for errors, maybe look at other error logs in my system, and if they're below a certain threshold, great, I'm going to trust the fact that my code is working, so now ramp it up to 20%, and then 30, and then eventually up to 100%. So you can not only use the portal, you can also completely programmatically drive the way in which you bleed traffic over to a new version of your code. Okay, so real quick, the question was, what happens if you're doing a change to your databases? I admit, I'm showing you how to do stuff with the website. With the databases, right now, that's still, admittedly, a do-it-yourself exercise. Again, we'll continue working on it and trying to improve that in the future. But today, everything you're seeing is specifically about the website code. So there's another thing, though, that I wanted to call out about how we set up the slots and how they work in the background, because it's not just about having this logical segmentation so that if you accidentally have bad code running in your website, you don't blow up your production customers. There's also the fact of the performance implications of going out and running different versions of code. Now, by default, it's a somewhat not well understood concept, but in Azure websites, when you run on a set of virtual machines, we call that set of virtual machines a web hosting plan. And if you're using the newer preview portal and you're here in the website blade, you can see right here, right at the very top, there's that smaller icon and it says web hosting plan. And if you click into that, it actually will give you some details, both performance metrics, as well as what we're interested here is how many VMs and what size of VMs am I actually running for this site. Now, this is important because if you start out working with Azure websites on day one, you probably don't realize it. You created a website, and if you don't sort of drill into the creation flow, you'll automatically end up on a small VM, and you probably can forget about it. But over time, if you're creating a lot of websites and a lot of slots, you will invariably get to a point where you want to have certain sites and certain slots running on different sets of virtual machines, specifically so that you don't adversely impact the performance of your production sites. And that's exactly what we did here. So you can see up at the very top of the portal page, it says travelappne_prod_WHP. That's a name I gave the web hosting plan when I created it. So as you can imagine, it says, great, this is the pool of VMs for my main production site running in North Europe. Now if we go back and take a look at the deployment slots, once again, you might not have keyed in on it when we were looking at it earlier, but you see this column here that says web hosting plan. You can see that I've got the dev slot running in its own web hosting plan, and I've got the prod B slot running in its own hosting plan. So each one of those three slots is on an independent set of virtual machines. And so, for example, when I'm warming up that prod B site, it might be grinding away the CPU and beating up the memory. It's okay. It's on its own set of virtual machines. Everyone who's over here running on the production site, they're never going to know that's happening because they're on a completely different set of VMs. And when I know this guy's warmed up, that's where I use testing in production to start bleeding traffic over to that prod B slot. And when my customers arrive here, hopefully they're happy because I know the code works. And, oh, by the way, the VMs are all warmed up and actually running instead of being cold. The other nice thing about this is that you can go out and scale the web hosting plans differently. So, for example, you can run your dev web hosting plan on a bunch of small VMs. You can run your main production slot on a bunch of large VMs. And if you have something here like prod B, you can have it scaled down to next to nothing when it's not in use, scale it up ahead of time, warm it up, and then bleed traffic over to it. So with that sort of quick intro to web hosting plans, one other thing I did want to just call out is if you're wondering, like, okay, how do I actually create one of these suckers? Let me drill in here to the dev slot of my site. So I'm pulled up here in the blade, travelne-dev. And if I want to, on day one, if I want to basically assign it to a new web hosting plan, over here to the side where there are these three dots, again, not the most obvious thing, but if you click on it, you can see, oh, lo and behold, there's a web hosting plan button. And this is what I did a few weeks ago. I went in after I created the slot, and I said, great, give me a new web hosting plan. And you can go ahead and pick the size and the number of instances and give it a name. And then when you go ahead and click through and say OK to all of that, it will end up saving it. And this site will end up being moved off onto those pools of virtual machines. So definitely keep that in mind. For any kind of sort of heavy-duty usage of Azure websites, at some point you will want to come up with a plan on how to divvy up your sites across different web hosting plans. All right, so let's split back here to the main site. So I'm going to clear out all the deployment slots, and we're going to scroll up here to the top, and I'm actually going to drill into the details of the web hosting plan for my main site. And what I'm hovered over here is the autoscale part. Now, autoscale, I think probably a lot of you are familiar with it, right? It gives you a way to define how and when we should scale up or down the number of instances associated with your website. Currently, I have performance-based autoscaling turned on. And one of the nice things here is you can see here there's this little right-leaning arrow. If I click into it, it gives me a somewhat saner explanation of actually what the heck the autoscale rule is really doing. So you can see the autoscale rule says I'm going to trigger off of CPU, and oh look, if the CPU is greater than 5%, and I've observed that over the last 5 minutes, then go give me another instance in my web hosting plan, and then hang out for 5 minutes. Basically, after I make that change, let things stabilize. And then similarly, I have a scale down rule. So I've said, okay, if the CPU is less than 7% over the last 5 minutes, deallocate one of the VMs, and then again, just sort of cool down for 5 minutes and don't do anything. Let the change settle out before I start sampling again. And what's really cool about this is I can actually add multiple rules to my autoscale definition. So I can say if something goes on with CPU or if something goes on with memory, then go out and basically scale up or scale down. So there's a lot of great functionality for this. And like I said, if you're looking for it, if you take a look in the preview portal, you can find it. The other nice thing I can do with my web hosting plans is we collect metrics at both the web hosting plan and the website level. And again, that's very important because once you move beyond running one site on one set of VMs, you're quickly going to want to start asking questions about the performance of your virtual machines versus the performance of any individual site running on that pool of virtual machines. So one, again, maybe not the most clear thing here, but if you right-click on this chart, you get a nice little option that says Edit. And what you can do then is you can see the available metrics that we track for all of the virtual machines in a web hosting plan. And you can see right now, I've specifically said monitor CPU, network egress, data out, and memory percentages. But I can add the other three if I want them. And the nice thing about that is when I click into the chart directly, I can add alerts. And you can see right here, I set up a demo alert a while ago that said, hey, go monitor CPU percentage, and if it goes over 5% over 5 minutes, go ahead and A, trigger the alert, and also please email me. And in fact, I think if I look here in the background, sure enough, this is the Outlook account I have for my site, and I can see that the alert was triggered telling me that, whoop, for the travel app in the Northeast in the production web hosting plan, the CPU percentage did go above 5 minutes, or it did go above 5% over 5 minutes. And what will happen is, again, after a certain period of time, after a few minutes, if the CPU percentage drops back down again, I'll get more notifications telling me that basically I've gone green on the alert and things are back to normalcy. And then, like I said earlier, I'd alluded to the fact that a lot of these metrics and alerting are also available at the website level. So I've come back here to the website blade, and if I click into the metrics here, again, if I want to, I can change, you know, add, remove any metrics that I want to collect at the website level. You can see that the metrics are a bit different. There are some things like data out that are the same, both at the web hosting plan and the website level. Other metrics we collect at a more granular level for websites, because we find some customers do want to know, for example, when there's an elevated number of server errors, or let me know how much memory an individual website is using. But the idea is the same. You can select one or more metrics to look at, and then in this case, I haven't set up any alerts, but I can set up alerts that run at the website level, and I can choose any of the metrics that I actually have already chosen to graph. So right now, since I'm only graphing server errors and requests, that's all I see here in the dropdown. But again, like I said earlier, all you need to do is right-click on this guy, edit chart, and you can add more metrics, and as a result, you can then alert off of them. So overall, I think we've got a pretty good set of, you know, capabilities that you can use after you've gone into production to monitor both the load on your, on the pool of virtual machines that you're using, as well as the performance characteristics of individual websites that are running on that set of virtual machines. So one last thing I wanted to cover very quickly, again, it's in the area of performance. A short while ago, we had introduced CDN support for Azure websites. So Azure itself all up has CDN support. And what we did here for a demo app a little while ago is we went into the production version of our portal and we came in here and said, hey, go create me a new CDN endpoint. And now in this case, when you do it, it will list off all of your different accounts, including websites that are available for integrating with CDN. And in our case, when we did that, you can see what the end result was. We basically said, hey, for our custom domain of travel.contosoweb.net, we would like CDN support for it. And what we're given is a somewhat funky looking URL, but that's the URL that's recognized by the CDN network. And then the way we make use of that in our app is just by choosing the sets of resources that we want to be CDN cacheable. So if I go back in here into IE and turn on the network trace, I should be able to see where a number of these different requests are coming from. And sure enough, you can see that somewhat odd-looking URL, right? So we're serving style sheets, our modernizer framework in ASP.NET. There's a number of AJAX frameworks that are used in this that, again, we also put up here on the CDN. So, you know, it's simple to go out and use, because literally all you do is you go into your app, whether it's your pages or your AJAX framework, you name it, you change the base URL that all of the relative paths are going to be evaluated off of. And in this case, we changed the base domain to be this AZ6, et cetera, URL. And then you're done. And what happens at runtime is, you know, somebody running here in the browser, if they ask for a style sheet from the CDN network and there's a cache miss, that's okay. The CDN will end up retrieving it from our server, running in Azure websites. It'll cache it. And then from that point onwards, as customers access your site, they'll end up getting a cache hit, and they'll get the content a lot faster coming off of the CDN's edge nodes, as opposed to having to route all the way back to your web server. Okay, so I think at this point we've probably done a really good run through of what's going on in the app from the point of view of performance. Now I want to drill into a few of the other, you know, capabilities and functionality here that we've got in the app. And specifically, it's sort of like, okay, I've got this app. We already know that it pulls up some data from SQL Server. Let's actually drill in here a little bit and create a new travel request and kick off some more functionality in the background. So the first thing I'm going to do is click in this dropdown, and you'll notice that this data, it's not actually coming from the application itself. It's actually coming from a REST API call that we're making out to the Salesforce service. And the reason why that's working is, again, because we've done a bunch of setup in the background that ultimately registers this app as well as Salesforce with Azure Active Directory, and that allows us to go out and query it. So we'll go out and we'll select a customer account from Salesforce, and it actually populates the data down here, again, in this text box. It is also all being pulled from Salesforce. And I'll say, remember to bring the demo materials this time. And we'll go out and we'll save this travel record into our system. Now, when I go out and I click save, there's actually a heck of a lot of stuff that gets kicked off in the background by this web application. It's going out and writing a record back to our on-premises SQL server. It's going out and writing a bunch of artifacts into SharePoint in our Office 365 tenancy. It's writing some values back into Salesforce. And it's also dropping a record into an Azure queue so that a web job that we have running in the background can pick up that queue message and actually do something with it. In this case, go send an email. And the reason why we have this app running around doing, you know, five different things is, again, this is a common pattern more generally for what we see, especially with enterprise customers moving up to the cloud. Right? We recognize the fact you've already got existing data and investments in on-premises systems, and it's highly unlikely those are ever going to go away. But at the same time, there's all this rapid development going on with SaaS and cloud services that you want to take advantage of. And so what we see is a very common pattern of customers wanting to build apps, run them in the cloud, but those apps have to be able to span both the existing on-premises capabilities of their company as well as taking advantage of services that are available out there in the cloud. And that's exactly what this application does underneath the hood. So let's walk through a number of those different pieces that I've been talking about. I've been bringing up Active Directory multiple times. So again, looking in here at the production Azure portal, if I take a look at the Azure Active Directory setup, you'll see we have Azure AED created and registered for domain contosoweb.net, which matches, of course, our web app, which is in contosoweb.net. And then furthermore, we went ahead and we turned on directory synchronization a while ago. And if you've worked with Azure AED, you know there's a tool called, I think it's DIR Sync, that is used to go out and synchronize credentials from on-prem up into Azure AED. And you can actually see the end result of that if we click into the users that are known to this directory, because you can see there I am, Stefan. There's the login I've been using today, contosoweb.net, and there you can see the fact that that user account was sourced from the local, aka on-premises Active Directory. It's not an account that was just created out of thin air inside of Azure. And to sort of prove that and drive the point home, I've RDP'd here into the Active Directory domain controller that we have running live in our Azure VNet, and you can see this is my account that's set up in my on-premises directory. So ultimately, that whole chain of connected events results in me being able to go out and go to my web app in Azure websites. I have it set up using WIF, so it ends up redirecting ultimately to Azure AED. Azure AED recognizes my on-prem Active Directory. I have an ADFS endpoint set up on my directory controller. So ultimately, it's my domain controller that's validating the fact that my user and password are real and correct. And then because of the fact that Azure AED and my domain are integrated, Azure Active Directory will create a security token and give it back to my web app. And my web app itself is also registered with Azure Active Directory. So you can see I've registered my travel web app, as well as my O365 tenancy, as well as Salesforce. And because of that, I'm able to, in my web app, get that security token from Azure Active Directory, and then I can turn around and use it to basically authenticate against Salesforce and authenticate against Office 365. And so, for example, if I click in here to my travel record, we dropped in a handy little link to the artifacts that we created in SharePoint. And you'll notice I don't actually have to sit there and type in my creds all over again, right? Office 365 is saying, oh, for this tenancy, who is this person? And it sees that, okay, well, you know, I'm integrated with Azure AD, I've got a security token, and apparently I'm granted access to the tenancy. And so without me actually having to type in my creds, I am still getting the end result that I want, which is single sign-on against my O365 tenancy. And if I drill in here, I can see, sure enough, there's the item that I created in my SharePoint list that was one of the side effects from creating a travel record in my application. And what's actually really cool about this is not only is my application created an entry in a SharePoint list, if you happen to have developers or you work with an ISV who knows how to code against SharePoint Online, they could go out and build an entire workflow that itself keys off of the fact that a new item showed up in this list. So again, sort of reiterating that point that in many cases, building these web apps, running them in the cloud, it's almost like hooking up a chain of dominoes. And the first domino is something you do in the website, but it ends up doing something else, which triggers something else, which triggers something else. And then the other thing we did in the context of our app, we also created a handy-dandy little travel document. So again, it's a little Word document. We posted it to the document collection we have here in SharePoint Online. And so my employees, when they're traveling, they can go ahead and print this out. You know, maybe they have to go submit it as an expense report or something. So that's what's going on from the Office 365 standpoint. So let's come back again here into the main page of the app. And we'll notice that we now have two records showing here. And I mentioned earlier that these records actually come from the database. So let's go ahead and RDP back and take a look at my on-premises SQL Server. So this is just a regular old SQL Server setup running in an infrastructure as a service VM. And it's deployed again in a VNet running up in Azure. And if I go ahead and refresh this query, you'll see, sure enough, now we've got two rows of data showing up. So proof that we are actually going out and successfully reading and writing data from just a regular old SQL Server. So how the heck did we actually make it to that SQL Server in the first place? Well, come in here to the preview portal, and we'll go ahead and take a look at some of the connection strings that we have set up for our application. And if I scroll down here a bit, I'll see that, for example, I have this mycompany.travel connection string. And take a look at what that connection string looks like, right? TCP:10.0.1.6. Well, okay, that's not a SQL Azure endpoint, certainly not an internet addressable endpoint. So it's clearly right, pointed at something that looks very on-premise-y like. Now, the reason why that works is for my app, as I mentioned earlier, we're using the VPN connectivity to VNets that was introduced just a while ago. So if I scroll down here a bit, you'll see we actually have both of our enterprise connectivity options available to you in the portal, the VPN connectivity to VNets as well as hybrid connections. And in this case, I can see that I'm connected to a virtual network that's called AntDemo VN. Now, before I switch over to that, just a quick note on hybrid connections. I talked actually quite a bit about hybrid connections in a similar talk a few months ago at TechEd US. If you're interested in it, I'd highly recommend sort of zooming forward in that talk and taking a look at the hybrid connections info. The salient thing here for all the folks today is sort of when do I use one or the other? The idea behind the VPN connectivity to virtual networks is we get a lot of questions from customers who already have VNets set up and in many cases have those virtual networks set up with site-to-site connectivity all the way back to their on-premises networks. So if you're already using VNets today, and especially if you're using site-to-site connectivity, then it's sort of a no-brainer. You're going to want to probably go with the VPN connectivity because it'll clip in very nicely with what you've already got. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you might sort of look at all that and say, holy cow, that is a lot of mumbo jumbo, and I don't know what half those acronyms mean. That's okay. That's in large part the whole point behind hybrid connections. You don't have to sit there and say, oh man, I'm going to set up a VNet, and then do I need site to site? Instead, you just say, look, I have a machine. It can be literally running underneath your desk at work. And what you do is you create a hybrid connection. It will give you an MSI package. You install it on that machine. And what effectively is happening is there's an HTTP listener hooked up to the service bus cloud running up in Azure. And then on our side, you basically connect your website to that hybrid connection. And now what's happening is TCP/IP packets, like, for example, the SQL Server, actually get diced and sliced into little messages that eventually flow down that HTTP relay all the way down to the machine running underneath your desk where you installed the hybrid connections MSI. So it's a very simple, very fast way to get up and running and get connectivity to an individual machine or an individual set of endpoints running on your network. So let's come back here to the VNet, and I'm going to blip back to the production portal and pull up the dashboard page for AntDemo VN. So you can see there's a virtual network. It tells me I've got 7 clients, which isn't surprising because 6 of those are for my production, my dev, and my prod B slots running in West US as well as running in North Europe. So that accounts for 6 of the connections into my VNet. And if I scroll down a little bit, you'll see how the IP addresses are allocated. And sure enough, there's our 10.0.1.6 endpoint. So that's our SQL Server that all of the instances of our website are connected to, and they're connecting over this VPN connection. Now, another cool thing about the virtual network connectivity is because of the fact that it's an attribute of the website, it's actually independent of whatever coding technology you're using in your website. So what I mean by that is even though I'm running an MVC app, the virtual network connectivity works regardless for PHP, for Node.js, for Python, and for any of the other frameworks that we support on websites. And to give you an example of that, we've got a web job that's configured on this website that's written in Java. It's not written in .NET. Furthermore, it's a web job. It's not a website. So it's a piece of just sort of asynchronous background code that's hanging out there. And fundamentally, what it does is it queries the database whenever it sees a message land in an Azure queue, and then it sends an email. And so you can see, sure enough, there's our travel request, GenePoint, and great, it sent me a nice convenient link to SharePoint. So how did that web job actually pull off sending that email? Let's take a look at that. So first off, coming back to my website, scroll up a bit, and we'll see, okay, I've got 2 web jobs configured. The first one is actually a .NET web job written in C#, and we turned it off. And then we also wrote the exact same logic, but we wrote it in Java, and this is the Java web job. So it's happily sitting there running in the background. Now the code itself is pretty straightforward. It's written by one of the other devs on our team. And basically what it did is it starts out hanging out, listening for a queue message on an Azure queue. And so it's using the Azure Java libraries, and it's listening for messages to show up in this travel request queue. And remember what I said earlier, when we create a travel request in our app, one of the things we do is we write an entry into this queue. So every 5 seconds, this Java web job is happily chugging along in the background, and it wakes up and it sees, aha, a message arrived. And so the next thing it's going to do is it's going to say, hey, I need to actually get a connection to my database because I want to run a simple query, get some info, and then I'm going to send an email. So let's take a look at how it actually got the connection string. Down here, you can see the connection string is not actually hard-coded into the Java web job. It's reading it from an environment variable. And the reason why this works is one of the really nice features about Azure websites is that you don't have to have all of your secrets hard-coded into your app or sitting around in the clear in various text files. Instead, what you can do, for example, is you can store them as pieces of configuration information associated with your website. So, for example, here, I've got a piece of configuration information called JDBC string. And again, if you look at it, at the beginning of it, that's your Java JDBC string. In this case, once again, pointed at the IP address of my on-premises SQL server. So just to drive home the point that the VNet connectivity, it's a network layer thing. Doesn't matter what you run on top of it, any language we support, you can go ahead and route through to any endpoint over VPN. So what we do at runtime, when we spin up that web job, just like when we spin up a website, is we take all of these connection strings and we materialize them as environment variables in the process block associated with the worker process or the web job. And that's why in Java, what I do is first, I have this prepended value, and this is something we, Azure websites, use to differentiate the different kinds of environment variables. So in this case, the kind of connection string was a custom connection string. So we say custom con str underscore. And then you can see there's the key that we used for setting up our connection string, JDBC string. And you see right here off to the side, it's custom. So that's how we go from having the value in the portal to spinning up the web job, putting all of those connection strings in as environment variables, and then you can pull it back out in your code. And again, that approach works with any language that we support today on Azure websites. Okay, so hopefully that gives you a good run through of what we can do with the Java web job. The one last thing, just FYI, in terms of how we sent the email, what we did is we set up an account with SendGrid. They're one of the many partners who are actually available in the Azure store. I'm sure a number of you have used them before. It's very straightforward. You sign up for an account, you get some credentials, and then you just use any of their object models. And again, they have object models for .NET, Java, for other frameworks, and you just go out and cruft up the email and send it, in this case, to my Outlook account, and it's as simple as that. Okay, so let's switch back into the app and take a look at some other features. So I had mentioned that, again, one of the things this app does in the background is that it writes some artifacts into Salesforce. You saw that in the dropdown where it retrieved customer accounts, it was coming from Salesforce. Well, here I am logged into a developer account in Salesforce. And if you remember, we had gone out and worked with an account called GenePoint. So I'll click into it and scroll down a bit, and you'll see that, sure enough, just a few minutes ago, we created a travel request and dropped it here into Salesforce. And so again, that's one of the things we're doing behind the scenes in this web app. Because the app, as well as Salesforce, are both trusted by Azure Active Directory, the code running in the background in that web app is able to authenticate against Salesforce and carry out CRUD operations, in this case, creating a travel request inside of Salesforce each and every time I create a travel request in the web app. Okay, so I think that gives you a pretty complete run-through of sort of all the myriad things that get kicked off in the background every single time we say, let's create a travel request. I wanted to switch gears a little bit and take a look at, real quickly, a handful of the uptime sort of health capabilities that we have built into Azure websites. And the first one I wanted to look at is a feature called Always On. So let me actually click through here and find it. So first off, to turn on the Always On feature, as I always like to joke, it's very simple. You click the On button, and now you're always on. Okay. It's my second coming as a comedian, or not. So the general idea behind Always On is actually very simple. It's, we know that you've got an app running on one or more VMs, and we're going to guess that you actually want the app to stay up and running in memory. And so behind the scenes in Azure websites, when you enable this, there's a pinger that's just sitting there poking the root URL of your site. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, because remember, all of your sites run on VMs in a web hosting plan. And that means you can have many VMs in a web hosting plan. And when you enable Always On, we're not just pinging the root URL of your site, we're making sure that your site is actually up and running in a worker process on every single virtual machine that you've specified in that web hosting plan. And that means that, for example, if in the cloud, the physical piece of hardware that one of your VMs is on happened to die, well, guess what? We're going to come along, and we're going to go poke you and say, oh, guess what? You were supposed to be up and running on VM number 6. You appear to have gone away. Here, let me bring up VM number 6 somewhere else on a completely different node, and I'm going to go out and ping it and make sure you're up and running. So, like I said, maybe a little bit hard to find in the UX, but definitely very simple to turn on feature and highly recommended for any of your production apps just to make sure you're sort of always up, running, and warm in memory. Now, the other thing that's related to sort of uptime is a feature that we refer to as auto heal, but it does require some input on your part to sort of tell us what to do. So the auto heal feature is actually an IIS module that we have installed on all of our, virtual machines. So you don't need to install any software. You just need to sort of program it, as it were, in webconfig. And what you do is, in your webconfig, you drop in a system.webserver section, and there's this new section called monitoring. And what you do is you tell our auto heal module one or more triggers, and when the triggers are hit, you tell us what action to take. So, for example, what I have set up here is very simple. I sort of have a nonsensical trigger that says, if I see more than a million requests to my app on this specific virtual machine in 30 seconds, go out and recycle the worker process. But what's cool is that there are a number of other triggers that you can pick. And so, for example, a fair number of customers use the memory-based trigger. And this is something that I suspect a lot of us have done for a long time in our on-premises IIS setups. You basically sit there and say, hey, if this app pool uses up too much memory, go reboot it. Or basically, in the case of the app pool, go recycle it. And that's exactly what you can do here. You can trigger recycles based upon status codes. And my favorite is you can trigger them based upon slow requests. So we have logic in the auto heal module that will track how much time it took for each individual request to actually run. And so, for example, here in the comments, this is basically saying if a request took more than 59 seconds, and if I saw 5 occurrences of that in the last 5 minutes, then you should consider the trigger to have fired and you should do something. For example, recycle the app pool. And that turns out to be very, very useful, frequently for very hard to debug and trace problems that come up in production. And frequently, it may take you days or weeks to figure out what's going on in your app, but in the interim, you need to do something to try to keep your site up and running. And so being able to say, hey, if there are too many slow requests, I know my app has melted down again, just please sort of recycle it so most of my customers don't actually notice any kind of negative impact. Now, some of the other actions are you can log an event, which basically means we would have done something, but we don't actually carry out an action. And then the most powerful one is this guy, the custom action. Now, this actually, you know, there's a fair amount you can end up doing with it. You can basically run arbitrary executables. At the end of this PowerPoint deck, if you look at it afterwards, there are a lot of links I included. One of them is to a great blog post about how you can configure the auto heal feature. And it shows you how you can use this custom action element to use Mark Rasinovich's proc dump utility to take memory dumps. So remember earlier I mentioned there's this memory-based trigger. So you could go out and set a memory-based trigger that says when there's excessive memory consumption, go fire a custom action, which is to go take a memory dump with proc dump. And we actually have customers who do that today. They zip up the dump, they send it to our support folks, and then we can sit there and try to debug it and figure out actually what's going on and what's going wrong in their web app. Okay, so I think the final thing that I wanted to cover today was making use of Traffic Manager. And I had mentioned at the onset of the presentation that we actually have the site deployed in two physical regions, two different Azure data centers, right? And we can see it here. I have my instance in North Europe, and I have my instance in West US. So we've already seen it running in North Europe, right? We saw this in the upper right-hand corner showing us that we're running in North Europe. So let's beam in here to a virtual machine that I have running out of the West US data center. And once again, we'll log in with my good old creds. Give it a second there. And after this guy is done logging in, what we should see in the upper right-hand corner is that this app is actually being served out of the West US data center. So sure enough, it's telling me that this instance of the app is coming out of the West US. And the reason why is I have a performance-based traffic manager profile that is actually sitting in front of my app. And of course, as you would expect, when I'm accessing the application from a virtual machine that's running somewhere out of California, it's going to say, okay, guess what? I should probably serve the requests off of the instance of my website that's also running in the West US. And you can see we're looking at the exact same data. So we're connecting to the exact same VNet. And behind the scenes, again, it's all wired up and it connects to the same Azure Active Directory, same Salesforce, same Office 365 tenancy. So let's take a look at how some of that is actually wired up. So I'm back here in the main production portal. And you can see here, this time around, I'm showing the page for Traffic Manager. And this is for the endpoints that I have configured. So you can see I've added one endpoint for my North Europe presence and one for my West US presence. And you can also see it here in the column, in the location column. And if I wanted to, I can choose to add additional endpoints to the profile. Now, what's really cool about Traffic Manager is that I can add endpoints from both Azure websites as well as cloud services. So I can actually make use of instances of my app deployed across different compute workloads. And then the other thing that's really cool, it's not available here in the UX, but you can do it through the REST API for Traffic Manager, is you can also add endpoints to your profile that are outside of Azure. So you could literally go out and have an instance of this web app running on your own hardware in your corporate data center and add that endpoint to this profile. And you could choose to sit there and make a decision. Do I run the web app out of my own data center or do I run it out of the cloud? And that starts giving you some very powerful options for things like load balancing when you have spike loads that you know you only temporarily have to account for, and maybe you only want to run the website in the cloud for a short time just to account for those. It also makes it possible to do DR scenarios. So you could sit there and say, you know, maybe my management isn't fully comfortable with this running in the cloud thing. No problem. I'll put my site behind a Traffic Manager profile, and I can show that if something fails, it'll always fail back to my on-premises instance. And if I take a look here in the configuration for the profile, you'll see that today I've got it set up for, like I said, performance-based balancing, but there's also an option here down at the bottom for setting up other ones, such as, you know, round robin or failover. And failover is the one that, again, a number of our customers end up using in order to provide DR guarantees by running multiple instances of their site in multiple data centers. Now, one other interesting thing I wanted to point out is frequently people scratch their heads and they're like, yeah, so I believe you that this is working, but how the heck does it actually work? So you see here right in the middle, there's this DNS name, Travel App. .trafficmanager.net. So keep that in mind. And let's go out here from my laptop and do an NS lookup for the demo site that we've been playing around with. So you see, I did a lookup on travelcontosoweb.net. And look at what the first response was that came back. It said, oh, you know something? Contosoweb.net actually points at travelapp.trafficmanager.net. And that's actually the custom domain that we've registered with our profile in Traffic Manager. And that is the important glue that binds the custom host name of your website to the Traffic Manager service. And what happens then when I'm running in the browser and I'm saying as a customer, I'd like to go to travel.contosoweb.net, the DNS lookup hits Traffic Manager and it says, oh, for travelapp.trafficmanager.net, it looks like you wanted a performance-based evaluation of what the nearest instance or nearest endpoint is that I should actually point your customer at. And since I'm running here right in Spain, of course it's going to say, well, guess what? The closest instance of my website is the one running out of the North Europe data center. And then the final resolution actually lands in a specific instance of a scale unit that's running there. And that, in a nutshell, is how you go from setting up a domain in Traffic Manager to how at runtime the requests actually resolve down to the appropriate running instance of your site. Okay, so I think at this point we've pretty much run through everything I wanted to get through in the app. We'll switch back to the slides real quick. Hopefully you've got a really, really good run through of what it's like to run an example enterprise app that has a lot of sort of tendrils out the back end. You saw it's able to touch and integrate with my on-premises SQL server, uses my corporate Active Directory, but it's able to project my digital identity, as it were, out into the cloud to those other services like Office 365 and Salesforce. You saw how we could scale the app. So remember, multiple web hosting plans, put your different slots on independent web hosting plans so you can scale and manage them independently. And then we put everything behind a Traffic Manager profile to give us that global scale. And then there is an array of DevOps functionality. I'm only able to scratch the surface of it here today, but you saw that you could get very detailed metrics, both from the point of view of the virtual machines in your web hosting plan, as well as your individual websites. And you can make decisions like auto-scaling or firing alerts based upon that information. So one last thing, I do want to call out that we have two other talks going on about Azure websites here at the conference. There's a great one tomorrow afternoon at 5 p.m. where there's going to be Ahmed, one of our developers who works on what we call the Kudu toolset. Again, I suspect a number of you recognize that name. He's going to be diving into a lot of the functionality that's available there. And then Andrew, another member of our team, is going to be here Friday. And from noon to 1:15, if you're curious about a number of the performance concepts I've been talking about, he's going to be drilling into examples of what it means to go from having just a little old web app to basically scaling it up massively around the world and making the necessary changes to it so it can handle millions and millions of hits. So that's basically the talk, folks. Thanks for dropping by. We probably got about 5 minutes if anyone has questions. And then I'm here this afternoon as well as Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday down in the Tech Expo floor. So if you've got questions, feel free to drop by the Azure section as well. Thanks again.